It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. We're about 6 weeks away from midterm elections. In the state of Illinois, there are some big races underway. Democrat Carol Moseley Braun is up for re-election in the U.S. Senate. She's challenged by Republican Peter Fitzgerald. Also, Glenn Pichard and George Ryan are squaring off to be the state's next governor. As these and other races heat up, it's time once again to examine how these campaigns are funded. Is too much money being spent? Do interest groups control politicians by funding their campaigns? Those are the perennial questions, but this hour's guests say the answers may surprise us. Joining us to discuss campaign finance in Illinois, Kent Redfield, professor of political studies, and Paul Quirk, professor of political science, both at the University of Illinois. This summer, they co-authored an Institute of Government and Public Affairs report entitled Reforming Campaign Finance in Illinois, Issues and Prospects. The report examines common voter concerns about how political campaigns are funded and offers recommendations for improving the state's campaign finance system. As we discuss campaign finance reform in Illinois, we welcome your questions and comments. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. First, I welcome here in the studio Paul Quirk to the Afternoon Magazine. Hi, Paul.
Thank you, Craig.
And also welcome to Kent Redfield, who is joining us via ISDN from the studios of WUIS in Springfield. Hi, Kent.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, and either one of you could probably answer this, what was the impetus for creating this report?
Well, let me try to describe that. I think that we felt that the debate about campaign finance reform in Illinois and even nationally was a difficult one, and it was frustrating, and that part of it wasn't going anywhere. And part of the difficulties, although not all of it, was due to the fact that the issue is really very confusing. There are multiple goals, multiple kinds of concerns. People advocate reforms that others say will do harm rather than good. And so we try to just kind of lay out in an orderly way what are all the things that people are concerned about campaign finance, which of these concerns really are valid, what's the data that supports them or doesn't support them with respect to Illinois, and in the end, what could be done about it. Now, in the end, even after you clarify things, there's a lot of obstacles to reform, but we hope that we've at least helped bring some clarity to those issues.
Kent, what separates Illinois' campaign finance system from other states?
Well, we have one of the most unregulated systems. There are no limits on who can contribute, how much they contribute, or when they can contribute. That makes us different from most states and very different from the federal system of very strict disclosure, contribution limits.
We actually point out that Illinois is exactly the least regulated state in the whole country, because of the things Kent has just been describing.
Paul, you mentioned a moment ago that there are concerns, certainly, that voters have about the current campaign finance system. What are some of those common concerns?
Well, one thing that people are concerned about is that there's too much money around. I think a lot of voters just think too much is spent. They see the numbers and find it outrageous. There's concern about how much of it is spent in ways that don't seem to provide any real enlightenment to voters, of advertising that's kind of superficial or even worse. They're concerned because so much money comes from major interest groups that have something to gain by making their contributions. And in Illinois, some of the people who are quite alert to politics are concerned about how much of the money is controlled by the legislative leaders, by the party leaders, both parties, both houses of the General Assembly, who actually collect a very large proportion of all the campaign money that's collected, and then they distribute it to those candidates that they want to distribute it to.
Do either of you see a direct proportion between amount of money a campaign has to spend and votes? I mean, is it just right bottom line a direct proportion there?
There are really two answers to that. One is the absence of money is almost always fatal in terms of a challenger running against an incumbent. If you don't get to a threshold that gives you visibility and viability, you are not going to win the election. I mean, the figures are uniform in terms of all studies that have been conducted. The second answer is that once you get into that threshold where candidates are viable, where you're on the radar screen, where people are taking you seriously and the voters are paying attention, then it is not necessarily fatal to get outspent 2-1 if your one is big enough. And often, particularly we see from some national studies, some of the biggest spenders are losing incumbents. Incumbents have an advantage in terms of raising money, but once you get into trouble, you get diminishing returns from the money you raise.
Now, Paul, there is no doubt, though, that the current system favors richer candidates over poorer.
Right. The real problem is that it's hard for candidates who may not be very well known to get themselves in a position of even being competitive. And there's a kind of a chicken and egg problem. If you don't have much visibility, you have trouble raising money. If you have trouble raising money, you don't get much visibility. And this kind of chicken and egg problem keeps a high percentage of all of the legislative races in Illinois and even congressional races non-competitive. There really is no doubt from the beginning who's going to win. And in many of the races, no opposing candidate even makes a serious effort. We think that you can argue that in such races, voters don't really have the full range of choices that they ought to have. The issues aren't really aired, and the incumbents aren't really held accountable.
From a voter standpoint, really, it's to a voter's benefit that both candidates have a significant amount of money, at least in the system as it stands right now, then.
Right. Even if you like the Republican in your district, you ought to want a system where a Democrat runs with some reasonable level of campaign funding and can make his case, just to help, if nothing else, to help you hold your Republican candidate accountable.
Now, why not just provide fixed public funds for campaigns? Maybe it could be part of taxes or something like that. Is that a viable option?
There are a couple of issues there. One, if you do public financing, it's a question of whether you're going to do it to the exclusion of private money or to supplement private money. If you do public financing in primaries, do public financing in general elections, it could get quite expensive. You always have a problem of a candidate running as a Democrat in a heavily Republican district who really wants to take public money and promote a particular issue. They're not really interested in running for office. If you're trying to drive private money out of the system under the current Supreme Court interpretations, while you can limit contributions, you cannot limit spending. And what has happened at the federal level, even in the presidential race, which they're supposed to be entirely funded by public money, there was probably more money spent outside of the system in terms of soft money, party money, issue ads, those sorts of things, than there was spent in terms of the public funds. So it is difficult to target the money, and there is, quite frankly, quite a bit of public resistance to public financing.
Let me add to that, or state what I think is kind of the bottom line. A lot of citizens believe that we should simply take all these campaign contributions out of politics, and that campaigns should be publicly funded. It's often pointed out that that's basically the system in most of the European democracies. And I think that at least a strong case can be made for that. But as Kent pointed out, in the United States, under current interpretation of constitutional law, we simply can't have that system because we cannot prohibit candidates from raising funds from other sources than the public sources. And that means that to make the system mainly publicly funded, you'd have to kind of spend enough publicly to overwhelm all of that private spending, and that would be a fabulous amount of money that nobody thinks we can afford. So people who would like the idea of public financing ought to hope that the Supreme Court changes its interpretation of the Constitution on these points.
One of the perennial debates going back and forth from one campaign to the next is the notion of providing free time on broadcast media outlets, so whether it be radio or TV or even print media, providing free something, you know, and just offering space or time or whatever the context would be. And do you think, either of you, that that would lead to a significant reduction in the amount of money that campaigns are spending?
I really don't think you're going to it's a question, are you trading that for something? Are people agreeing to limit their private fundraising? Are people agreeing to limit their spending in exchange for the free airtime? So it really doesn't impact on cost as much as it does on the amount of information that's out there. If you fund debates in exchange for something, if you provide free mailings, if you do voter guides, those sorts of things increase the amount of public information. It really isn't a cost consideration. That's, as Paul was saying earlier, one of the problems here is we have goals that sometimes run in opposite directions, making elections more competitive might make them more expensive. Making elections less expensive might make them also less competitive. And so this is a very difficult area to try and structure what is the best system.
We'd like to provide free something, though, Craig. But you have to be clear about what you're going to get from this and what you're not going to get. As Kent is saying, I think that we think that you could provide some support for campaigns and through that means improve the quality of information that voters got, and you might make some races more competitive, these races that we talked about, that where there was one candidate that just didn't have any money. But what you don't do by such a system is get the big contributions from interest groups from playing the important role that they do, because there's no way to give enough to overwhelm them, as I was saying.
Yeah, you mentioned the interest groups. I'd like to get into PAC money a little bit. There certainly is, as you mentioned, a concern among voters that PACs maintain too much control over politicians, that perhaps the money that they provide, if they're giving a big chunk of money, that maybe that's in exchange for votes. That's obviously, it's always been a concern. Do you think it's an appropriate concern? Is that true, or is there really any way to gauge that?
Well, it turns out that that's one of the bigger subjects that political scientists have tried to grapple with using empirical data, and it's hard to figure out. I think that most political scientists who've looked at data, and the data they look at is, say, roll call votes in Congress, you know, who votes for an interest group, who votes against it, and correlating that those votes with information on who got money from whom. It turns out that the statistical relationships in that data are not as strong as you might think. So the short answer is that we cannot demonstrate that there is a huge and direct effect of campaign contributions on how policy is made. But any political scientist also thinks it's very reasonable to be worried about this. Interest groups give money to candidates for something. They expect it to do some good for them, and that almost has to mean they think they're getting something out of policy.
Kent?
Yeah, most of the money from interest groups is going to incumbents. Most of the money is directed at preserving the status quo. And so when the beer distributors gives $400,000 to legislative candidates, they don't have a huge legislative agenda. Basically, they want the legislature not to raise taxes on alcohol and to be left alone. And so when the groups with money tend to be, by and large, interested in preserving the status quo, well, you have some exceptions. You know, the medical society and the trial lawyers will fight over tort reform. But most of the interest group money is directed at the legislative leaders who control the process and at members. And so the impact is there, but it is difficult to measure in terms of specific roll calls.
This is a problem not only for voters, but for the candidates themselves. I'm sure that candidates try to avoid any perception of a conflict of interest. They might accept money from organizations that have political views that are different from theirs. What can a candidate do in the current system?
Well, one of the things in terms of the system in Illinois, we have this contrast between uncompetitive races where there are no opponent, and then we have these races that are called targets, where the legislative leaders are focusing on particular elections. The district over there in Champaign, the 103rd, has been a targeted race the last three election cycles, and in those situations, the money is going from the interest groups to the legislative leaders. Last time around, about 60% of the money that Rick Winkle spent in the general election came from his legislative leader, and about 67% of the money that Naomi Jacobson spent came from her legislative leader. And so when the money goes from the Empress Casino or Waste Management to Lee Daniels or Mike Madigan, it's no longer Waste Management or casino money, it's the legislative leader's money.
Kent, how many races are truly competitive, then, would you say, in the state of Illinois?
We're only talking about a couple of dozen House races and 6 to 10 Senate races in any particular cycle, depending on how many Senate seats are up, since that fluctuates from year to year. I mean, you have natural boundaries where, like the south suburbs of Cook County, that are competitive. There are certain parts of the state that are viewed as swing districts. That's where the legislative leaders put their money.
So that suggests that really it's overwhelmingly. From one race to the next, there's really not much competition there.
Almost half of the situations you will have either no opponent or you have an opponent that spends less than $1,000. And another 25 to 30% are contested, but they're not competitive. And so the number of targeted races is really relatively small.
You mentioned a couple of the power players, I guess you would say, in Illinois politics, who, at least as far as your report is concerned, control where money is spent in the state of Illinois during campaigns. You refer to them as the four tops. Maybe you can explain who they are and their positions and how it is they have that kind of control or that kind of power.
Sure. Mike Madigan is the Speaker of the House. Lee Daniels is the House Minority Leader. Pate Phillips is the Senate President. Emil Jones is the Senate Minority Leader. We have in Illinois no limits on transfers. You can raise money in a political committee and then transfer it to another candidate. And so the legislative leaders raise large amounts of money, direct them at campaigns. They are also involved with working those campaigns. They recruit candidates. They perform most of the functions political parties perform. That makes them very influential in terms of who wins the election. When they get back to Springfield, they dominate the process because of their electoral power, their fundraising power, and their monopoly over staff, which does the professional work in Springfield, but then goes off the payroll and works the campaigns during the election season. The power in Springfield means that interest groups that don't care about who wins the elections give a disproportionate amount of their money to leaders as well as to incumbents. That gives the leaders more money to go out and spend in elections. That makes them more powerful in elections. That makes them more powerful in Springfield. So it is, you had a set of leaders that have been in power, except for Emil Jones, who replaced Phil Rock, since the early 80s. And so you have had a real concentration of power in terms of both elections and policy making in the hands of the legislative leaders over the almost a two-decade period.
So how do you two propose limiting their control?
Well, this would be one of the hardest things to accomplish politically, since it would have to be done through the political process that we've just said they control. The legal mechanism would be basically simple, and it would be to impose limitations on the amount of money that could be transferred from one political fundraising organization or committee to another. The trick is really passing it, that is, getting it adopted, and it's very hard to see how this will happen, except possibly in a period when the leadership is in transition. That is, when some of these people who have accumulated all of that money and all of that influence in the system are leaving, and there's an opportunity to kind of for the ordinary members to work out a new deal with the people who they elect to succeed them.
We are talking with Kent Redfield and Paul Quirk Kent is a professor of political studies at the University of Illinois in Springfield. He's also associate director of the Illinois Legislative Studies Center at UIS. And Paul Quirk is here in the studio with us. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana. He's also vice president of the public policy section of the American Political Science Association. Now, both have appointments in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the university. They are co-authors of the Institute report, Reforming Campaign Finance in Illinois, Issues and Prospects. We welcome your questions and comments. The phone number is to call 333-9455, that's in Champaign-Urbana, or 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere else. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. One of the things we've touched on just lightly so far is the fact that the state of Illinois allows office holders to divert those campaign funds for personal use. Does it make it harder then to, it's one of the catchphrases that we talk about certainly in the media, and I think people are aware of, follow the money, to track down where the money's coming from and where it ends up?
Well, this business about personal use probably doesn't have huge impacts on the ability to find out where money comes from or who's making contributions and therefore who might have influence. The big problem with it is that there are two problems. One is really there's an issue of integrity. That is, people contribute money for politics because they want to participate in politics. They don't want to buy a car or a boat or a vacation for an office holder. And under the system that we've had up until the reform that was adopted this summer, they really could have ended up doing that. The money could have gone for those kinds of purposes. The other problem with that is that money that a candidate can do whatever he wants with, spend it on a campaign or spend it on himself, is really a bit more valuable money than money that he could only spend on a campaign. So that it increases the influence over policymakers potentially. Now, we have really reformed most of this away just recently. That is, the governor did sign a bill that for the future, with some possibly dangerous loopholes, eliminates that practice.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you see as those loopholes.
Kent can do that.
What we've done is grandfathered in existing politicians. So whatever you had on hand as of June 30th of 1998, you can spend that amount of money for personal use. After January 1 of 99, you cannot spend campaign funds for personal use except that amount that you had in your committee as of June 30 of 1998. For someone who's being elected for the first time, it's not an issue. For someone who had almost no balance in their fund as of June 30th of this year, that's not a problem. The extreme example would be the Secretary of State, George Ryan, who's running for governor. He had $4.9 million in his fund. Even if he spends that down to almost zero and is elected governor during the course of the next 4 years, he could accumulate a balance up to $4.9 million that he could spend, convert for personal use. So eventually this will not be an issue. Everybody that has currently grandfathered in will leave office and close out their fund. But until that time, you've got that loophole.
There are some other loopholes that do go on permanently as well that bear watching and some concern. And one is that that candidates can borrow money from their campaigns, and another is that they can pay fees or salaries to themselves or to family members for so-called services rendered. And there is considerable potential for abuse in either of those exceptions.
If you had your druthers, how would the two of you have rewritten this bill if somebody said, okay, we're going to go on whatever you have to say? What would you do with it?
There are a couple of things. On the disclosure front, we will now have electronic filing, which is very positive. So candidates that have more than $25,000 of receipts or expenditures in a six-month period will have to file electronically. Those will get posted on the web. That's important in terms of giving the public access to the information, but it's not very timely. We have six-month filing or reporting periods. The information about the 98 election will become available after the 1st of February of 99. It is now possible with computer technology and the internet to do web-based filing on a transaction basis. There's been demonstration projects in other states, an attempt to do this with a gubernatorial candidate, so that you would have to file receipts and expenditure information within 10 days of the transaction, then it would be posted 10 days after that. So if you get a continuous rolling disclosure all the way through the period, then that's information that's valuable to the news media and, more importantly, to citizens before the election. Where's the money coming from? How is it being spent? So that's the next step that we need to take in terms of disclosure. Certainly on personal use, if it's wrong to spend money, campaign funds for personal use, it's wrong. And so the best thing would have been done just a flat-out ban. But, realistically, if you were going to pass the General Assembly, you couldn't have done that.
On some other matters, I think we would recommend in our report, bringing Illinois into line with the federal government and most other states and simply imposing some limitations on the contributions that can be made by private organizations or individuals to candidates or to parties. This limitation on transfers that we described from party leaders or party organizations to candidates, and some modest forms of public support for campaigns, what you referred to as free something. We're kind of open-minded about what it might be, but we're thinking of the state publishing a voter booklet that provides some information about all the candidates, or some financial support for mailings or for broadcasts, but not to the extent that you try to compete really with private money, just enough to get all campaigns on the radar screen somewhat.
Our phone number is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, and we have a caller on line one from Oakwood. Good afternoon.
Oh, I didn't hear all the programs, so you may have discussed this. One of the things that I think makes it hard for new candidates to get in is the incumbency, that the incumbents send out these newsletters, which, although they're using public money for them, and they do maybe provide some information, the pictures and everything, and they look a lot like campaign literature. It seems like it's hard for any new candidate to overcome a lot of that. And I wondered if you had any ideas on how that can be made a little more fair, or there a little less campaign literature.
That's a hard thing to deal with, in that we really don't want to interfere with legitimate communication between a member of the legislature and his district, and yet, as you, as the caller points out very correctly, this communication is often used essentially for campaigning. I think that we just have to hope that we can establish mechanisms for making the challengers more able to raise money to compete with that. And some form of public support for all campaigns would help to overcome it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, the legislature has wrestled with the deadline past which you cannot send out a district newsletter, and there have been a couple of flaps both on the Democrat and the Republican side during this campaign season. And so I think that's something that it's likely that the legislature will address again. And so you can't, the content is always, it's difficult to limit the content, but you certainly can do something about the timing. And so try to restrict them so that you increase the length of time between when they go out and when the actual campaign takes place.
I have a question. Are campaign contributions tax deductible?
Not in Illinois, and they at one time they were at the federal level. Some states have wrestled with, have tried programs that provide modest you know, tax deductions for small contributions, $50, $100, that as a matter of public policy, we ought to be encouraging small contributions and people participating in politics. And so that's one of the reform measures that is often discussed both at the national and at the state level is to try and encourage small contributions to compete with the big money contributions, is to provide some kind of tax deduction.
How can a voter that's going to give money to a campaign be assured that, in particular considering the system as we've been talking about it, can be assured that the money is going to that specific campaign?
If you give it to a candidate, the representatives that are running there in your particular district, it goes into their fund. If there's a competitive race, it's going to be spent there. If I contribute money to my state senator who has no race and the Senate president is trying to raise money for candidates in targeted races, my senator may make a contribution to that race out of his political fund. It's no longer my dollar when it, once it goes into his fund. And so the ease at which money flows through the system in Illinois makes that problematical.
We talked a little bit about the 98 Campaign Finance and Ethics Reform Bill. One of the proponents of such a package was Paul Simon, and I was curious if either of you wanted to comment on what kind of impact he had on getting that one through and what kind of impact he might have on future reform packages.
Kent was a little bit involved in that process as well, so Kent,
sure.
Kent ought to comment.
the Mike Lawrence, there was some Joyce Foundation funds a lot of work in this area. Gave a grant to the research center that Paul Simon heads at Carbondale. Mike Lawrence was the point man in terms of trying to put a package together that involved representatives from each of the four caucuses. And so this is an issue that's been something that that Senator Simon has been concerned about over a long period of time. And he brings a lot of credibility and visibility to the table. And so, his presence and then Mike Lawrence, who's was the former press secretary for Governor Edgar, his ability to work with the members and the staff directors really accomplished something that a lot of people did not think that would happen, was that Illinois would pass a gift ban and an ethics ban. I wouldn't minimize in any way what was done with that bill. There's a long way to go, but we certainly, in terms of ethics, have moved Illinois from the bottom up to the middle. I mean, most people would have assumed that it would have been illegal to hand a legislator a check as he walked off the House or the Senate floor, or illegal for a legislator to solicit a campaign contribution at a fundraiser in the morning from someone who had a bill in front of his committee in the afternoon. But all of those things used to be legal in Illinois. As of January 1st, they won't be.
If I could editorialize a little bit, I think it's fair to say that former Senator Simon is appearing to be bent on making him quite a useful former senator, and I think we all should be grateful for the role that he played in this.
We're talking with Paul Quirk, professor of political science at the University of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana, and Kent Redfield, professor of political studies at the University of Illinois at Springfield. They're co-authors of Reforming Campaign Finance in Illinois, Issues and Prospects. It's a report from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and that report was just put out this past July. We still have about 10 minutes or so left, enough time for a couple of calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, 333 WILL 1-800-222 WILL. A common voter complaint is that they don't know who to trust or what to believe. They don't know who these people are. How could some of the recommendations that you have in your report help voters to learn about candidates and to develop some sort of trust in the political process?
I'd like to comment on that and to say mainly that that has to do with a whole host of things that our report is not really about. Our report is about who pays for the campaigns and how they're paid for. There are very important questions about what campaigns consist of, and especially the nature of television advertising and politics. It's very widely held that the television advertising in campaigns causes cynicism and alienation and gives people very little information. We're inclined to agree with that. But you can't fix that just by changing how the money is spent or who it comes from. There are ideas that range from giving candidates free time on television with the restriction that they have to use it in 5-minute blocks and they have to be there in person to do the speaking and things like that that could help. There have been efforts by newspapers that are into what they call public journalism to try to do a more thorough job of focusing on issues in campaigns. But there's a whole set of very difficult issues about the quality of the discourse or the debate in campaigns, and they really do go beyond these questions about money.
Now, I think some of the things that were addressed in the reform bill this spring do get at kind of the perceptions of the basic integrity of the process. There were, you know, a lot of attention in terms of the MSI scandal involving bribes to people in public aid involving a state contract. And the things that were done in that bill in terms of defining and banning gifts from lobbyists to legislators and to state officials, the things involving where you can solicit campaigns, those sorts of things say that they're, you know, set some boundaries. The personal use. I mean, it's hard to get to this other conversation about building integrity and greater awareness until you get back past the point of saying, yes, there is right and wrong. There are ethical limits. And so we've started, you know, that it was valuable to do those sorts of things. Now we need to move on. Questions of limits will provide, you know, can help along those lines. Too narrow limits like we have at the federal level clearly force money out in other directions. But the converse of that is that if groups can give $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 to the legislative leaders, then you may not have corruption, but in lots of voters' minds, you at least have the appearance of corruption. And so putting some limits on what interest groups can give to candidates and to leaders will improve the way that people look at the system. So there are some things that can be done in terms of ethics and in terms of placing some limits and parameters on the system. But ultimately, then, you know, you get into, as Paul says, a whole other set of questions about the quality of the campaigns and the kind of discourse.
You've talked about the major hurdle or major problem in getting some of your recommendations in this report passed is that they have to go through the same power structure that maybe is causing some of those problems. Is it necessary in your minds to remove the current four tops that you mentioned to make any effective changes to the system? Either one of you can field this one.
We're not going to remove the four tops. At some point, they will retire.
Right.
And I think my implicit recommendation would be that if, say, the Democratic leader of the House retires, that the Democratic members of the House at the time that they nominate a new leader negotiate with the person who follows for a new set of understandings about mm-hmm. how campaign money will be handled. And eventually, these understandings perhaps can be even enacted into law. But I don't think we would, even if we could, remove the leaders over this one issue.
Yeah. From time to time, we'll have, over the course of several years, you know, some sort of political upheaval to some degree where a lot of members of either the state legislature or Congress on the national level will turn over the power structure. And the common complaint is, you know, yeah, there are times when voters will get to the point where they'll say, ah, throw the bums out. But then, you know, the complaint is, well, we just got new bums. What do you do?
Well, I, you know, that's always a consideration. But I think that part of this is a changing of the climate. And so in addition to those dramatic events and those opportunities for action, you know, we went from 1974 up until a couple of years ago without ever amending the law. We now have amended it twice. We've made some significant changes. Before, you had to fill out a form that had your name, your address, your occupation, and your employer, your phone number, and why you wanted to look at someone's campaign records before you could inspect their records, and a copy of that went to the candidate whose records you were looking at. A year from now, everybody's campaign records are going to be out on the internet, at least the candidates who have competitive races, most incumbent legislators and their opponents. That information is going to be out on the internet. So, you know, that we are going to, the technology is driving a real change in terms of how much information is out there. And people will modify their behavior because they don't want their opponent to make an issue of it, and they don't want to read about it in the newspaper or hear it on the radio or the TV. And so we're going to have a revolution in terms of how much information is out there, and that has the potential for forcing change. A number of candidates in this election cycle have made serious efforts at trying to issue challenges in terms of limiting spendings, have tried to make issues of how much money is coming in from outside the district. The problem for candidates in those really competitive targeted races is that it's real difficult to say, you know, my opponent's a bad person because he took 75% of his money from his leader, where I'm a good person because I only took, you know, 65% of my money from the leader. It's a little hard to make that argument.
We're not into to morally judging these leaders or the practices that they've engaged in or identifying who's bums and who's not particularly. You know, it really is a matter of the way the system developed, with everybody kind of trying to do their job and make it work better. The leaders found that they could raise money, found that by raising money they could help their party be more competitive statewide, and found that by targeting that, they could not only do that, they could help the party develop a more coherent program and platform. From the party leader's standpoint, what they are often doing is kind of limiting the parochial tendencies of individual members and helping the party to focus more on very broad goals to benefit the state and to benefit the party's position. We think that it's developed to a point where you've really lost more of the independence of individual legislators than Americans typically like to see, and something ought to be done about it. But it's not something where we see a conspiracy or lack of integrity on anybody's part.
Paul, in just the minute or so that we have left, are there any of your recommendations in this report that we could apply on a nationwide basis to the federal system?
The federal system has a little bit different situation, and it is that the federal system largely has the kind of campaign contribution limits that we would like to see. If anything, they are, as Kent mentioned very briefly, probably too low. They were set in the early 1970s and mm-hmm. haven't been raised. However, at the federal level, they have essentially been undermined by developments in regulation and the courts, which have caused soft money to be essentially unregulated. An interest group is only allowed to give $10,000 to a senator, but it can give $1 million to the party, and the party can use that money for advertising that is indistinguishable, really, from an ad that's put on by that candidate himself. So the federal limits have essentially broken down. What I think needs to be done at the federal level is to primarily to reform the soft money problem, get rid of that loophole.
Gentlemen, we are out of time, but I want to thank you both, Kent Redfield, Professor of Political Studies at the University of Illinois at Springfield, and Paul Quirk, Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana. Thank you both for joining us here on the Afternoon Magazine. I also want to say a special thanks to Illinois Public Radio member station WUIS for providing their facilities. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.